It's worth knowing what's really going on. This is the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to the podcast formerly known as Access Atlanta. I'm your host, Shane Harrison. You may have noticed the name on our logo has changed a little bit. That's just a placeholder because we are currently developing a brand new show that will have a new name and a new sound. We will be working on getting that right this summer. In the meantime, we'll be revisiting some of our favorite interviews from our first 4 years. As we do that, we'll continue our mission to get you ready for the weekend with a roundup of some of the fun, entertaining, and educational things to do in and around Atlanta in the coming days. Let's get started with a couple of those upcoming events. The artist, writer, and children's book illustrator Oliver Jeffers sees the world from unusual perspectives. He empathizes with crayons. He understands the temptation of a tasty book. In Ireland, he recently created a sculptural model of the solar system that was 9 kilometers long. That was the smallest he could make the installation, at a scale of 415 million to 1, such that the smallest heavenly bodies would still be visible. The idea was to give visitors a sense of the size of things. This is an overarching goal for Jeffers, who tries to introduce his audience to vantage points that they may have never considered. Experience Jeffers' point of view in a new exhibit at the High Museum of Art, Oliver Jeffers, 15 Years of Picturing Books, on display through August 17th, and in a show at the Alliance Theater, which will present an original musical based on Jeffers' book, The Incredible Book-Eating Boy, beginning July 13th. Read Bo Emerson's interview with Jeffers in Thursday's Living section in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and online at AJC.com. As always, Atlanta will host big celebrations for Independence Day, but sometimes smaller is better. Or maybe you'd just rather stay closer to home. Commemorate the 4th of July with community-based celebrations around Metro Atlanta and beyond, which offer a local feel with festivities for everyone. We've come up with a list of 10 community-based events that will mark Independence Day with live performances, parades, food, activities for kids, and plenty of red, white, and blue fireworks. You'll also find our look at the big celebration in Centennial Olympic Park, which returns this year as a ticketed event called Look Up Atlanta. Check out those stories on AJC.com. Stay tuned for more events later in the podcast, and after the featured conversation, we'll take a look at what the AJC is bringing you this week, both online and in print. But first, let's revisit a podcast from 2019, when we looked back at 1969's Atlanta International Pop Festival. 50 years later, some remembered it as the first opportunity to witness Led Zeppelin live in the South. Others recalled the steamy sun and hordes of, as one attendee called it, quote, hippies and wannabe hippies and people who were mentally hippies, unquote. A month before Woodstock would garner the headlines and catchphrases as the music festival that defined a generation, the Atlanta International Pop Festival and Atlanta International Raceway in Hampton established the city and the South as a meaningful player in the music industry. We spoke to some of the folks who were there. And keep in mind that the interview we're about to hear is from nearly 3 years ago, so any dates and events that may come up are in the past. Welcome to Access Atlanta. I'm your host, Shane Harrison, and this week we have once again as our guest, Melissa Ruggieri.
Hi.
So she is here, of course, to talk about something musical that happened a long time ago. And in addition, something that you can do now.
Yeah. You know, sorry, I sound like B. Arthur, by the way. It's just the way it is this week. But, you know, everybody talks about Woodstock and, you know, the anniversary of it this year. Of course, whatever's happening with that anniversary festival, we don't know.
Right.
But a lot of people have forgotten that there actually was a giant festival in Atlanta, the Atlanta International Pop Festival, that took place about a month and a half before Woodstock, July 4th and 5th. At Hampton, at the Atlanta Motor Speedway in Hampton, Georgia. And, you know, in reporting this story, it's always interesting to talk to people who did things 50 years ago because you have various answers to the same question sometimes. There doesn't seem to be a total consensus on what the crowd size was. Somewhere between 80,000 and 150,000 we're going with.
Yeah.
You know, because no one was keeping track of things in those days.
Yeah.
And there were other things about the festival that I had heard prior to doing some reporting, like it was the first U.S. appearance of Led Zeppelin. It was not.
Yeah.
It was, however, the first time anybody in the South really could have seen Led Zeppelin, because they had toured the West Coast about 6-8 months prior to that, and, you know, we're playing, you know, Washington State and Denver and, you know, California.
Right.
But if you lived over here, you did not have, and their first album had just come out that year also.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of a new band at the time,
yeah,
and people had been hearing about them. So that was certainly a huge deal. Janis Joplin was technically the headliner, even though Led Zeppelin kind of had the buzz.
Right.
And it was just, you know, I mean, when you look back at the lineup, it was Joplin, it was Creedence Clearwater Revival, it was Led Zeppelin, Spirit, just a ton of people over those 2 days. And people don't really realize what it did for the Atlanta music scene. And one thing, in talking to Peter Conlin, who is with Live Nation now, but he was a close friend of Alex Cooley and a former business partner, and Alex was one of the promoters who put on the International Pop Festival. Something else you learn when you do reporting.
Yeah.
Even though Alex is typically credited as the guy who put this whole thing together, well, he did, but along with 16 other people.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think is so important to remember, and this is something that Peter Conlin talked about when we interviewed him, is just what this festival did for the city of Atlanta.
Mm.
Because most acts, especially the British acts and acts who had not played much of the U.S. before, they looked at Atlanta as a redneck city.
Right.
And they were like, you know, why would we play there? A, there's probably not going to be enough interest. And B, do we really want to be amongst that crowd?
Right.
And what the Pop Festival really proved was that Atlanta could be a very meaningful musical outlet for a lot of these bands to play.
Right.
Someone else we spoke to, a fan who went, his name is David Michelson. He's a musician here, and he went to the Pop Festival, and he's loved talking about it. He's a great guy. And he said, you know, it was almost immediate after the Pop Festival that you started seeing bands like Fleetwood Mac and The Who and Savoy Brown and, you know, all these artists who never would have come here before, and even some of the California acts like Santana.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is a place to go. So it's kind of a cool thing. And here's Peter talking about just really what this festival wound up doing for Atlanta.
So we all know the story of don't do the brown acid at Woodstock, right?
Right.
I can't recall. Was it Grace Slick that told people not to
so,
do the brown
yeah.
acid?
I think so.
But yeah, there were apparently some bad drugs going around at Woodstock, and apparently there was some drug shenanigans going on at the Atlanta Pop Festival as well.
As there's always going to be drug shenanigans at a festival, right? Well, you know, one amazing thing was, It went very smoothly. I mean, there really wasn't a lot of problems as far as security and police. I think there's another story about a naked guy jumping on stage during Zeppelin. But even that, they handled it very nicely. Like, they, like, gently removed the guy from the stage. They didn't, like, tackle him. But I talked to James Pankow, who is the horn player and a founding member of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago played the festival. They were then known as the Chicago Transit Authority, as the CTA. And he told me this great story about, and he said, you know, you probably wouldn't know this story unless you were performing, because it was happening backstage, that one of the road guys, or one of the roadies, had tainted the other stagehand's water with LSD. So you had, like, a handful of stage guys who drank water with that were dosed, and they were out of commission the whole afternoon. They were laying on cots. Robin Conant, one of the promoters, told me he was working the stage. He was one of the ones who drank the water. Although he very amusingly said, you know, at that point, my body was kind of used to it.
Right.
So it didn't affect me. He said he was out for a couple of hours, like, having to lay on this cot. So so here's James Pankow telling that story about what happened backstage with the whole LSD incident. So what they're doing is this year for the anniversary, they are having a little reunion at Smith's Old Bar, which is very close to Piedmont Park.
Right.
And it also will be on July 7th. It just happens to be the same date that they did this 50 years ago. And they're still working on, you know, who might be coming to play or anything. But they really want people, you know, especially if you went to the festival or, you know, you heard about the festival or you just want to hang out and have a drink and reminisce. And, you know, because David Michelson was telling me so much about Spirit and how they just blew his mind that they were apparently like the band that people went in not really knowing a whole lot about, but came out going, oh my God, this was like the whole true hippie thing of, you know, one brain. And, and he said to this day, he's seen a million concerts, and he said to this day that stands out as like one of the best shows he's ever seen.
Yeah.
So it must, you know, it was a communal thing too. You know, he said, you know, like you were saying, we were talking earlier about, you know, the hippie people. And he said, you know, you got to this festival and you looked around. Because, again, no social media, no Facebook groups, no like-minded, you know, whatever, being able to converse someplace.
Right.
He said, you know, we show up, we look around, and we go, oh, my God, these people are all like us.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and there were areas nearby where they hung out.
Yeah.
And so they would just hang out, like, in Midtown, like, you know, up 10th Street and around there. There was an area, I can't even remember, I wish I could remember what they called it, the Strip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, so they would all hang out there. And so, you know, that probably helped in spreading the word for things like that.
Yes.
There were clubs and there were, you know, not as much, but there were, you know, they just hang out and the word would spread, I guess.
It's really pretty phenomenal. You know, it's hard to find photos from the event. You know, we've been trying to track some down. I was put in touch with a photographer, Philip Rawls, who did take some really nice pictures. He actually put out a commemorative calendar for the 50th anniversary, which has some great pictures that he took. And he wasn't really even like supposed to. He wasn't really like a licensed photographer. He somehow finagled. He worked for Atlantic Records in Memphis, and he somehow managed to get a press pass. But, you know, he was just there with his camera taking pictures and wasn't really for anything at the time.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, thankfully, you know, he's got a trove. And if you go online, there are a couple of Facebook pages that people have started that, you know, you could post your memorabilia. Peter Conlon has actually purchased memorabilia from the fest because Alex didn't save anything.
Yeah.
And it always frustrates him from all their time working together that he's like, I would be the one walking around behind Alex picking up stuff and saying, like, you know, you should say this. But, you know, he showed us when we went to interview him in his office, he has a t-shirt from the event that he paid like $4,000 for.
Oh.
You know, he has the original program. He paid $400 or $500 for a, you know, ticket from that somebody had, like a pristine ticket that, you know, was a couple hundred bucks as well. So, you know, if you have some of this stuff, apparently there's a market for it.
There's a market for a lot of that kind of stuff. Music
lots
memorabilia.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's out there, but, you know, as far as photos, you know, they're kind of sparse. We did track down some B-roll footage that WSB had from, I guess they sent a reporter out that day. So there's some, you know, shots of the crowd. And, you know, as you might expect, it was extremely hot because it was July in Georgia and there were no shade and no trees. But when you look at how what happened at Woodstock and then you look back at this, you kind of go, yeah, you know, that's pretty amazing that this whole thing could come together. Go off essentially without a hitch.
Yeah.
You've got, let's just call it 100,000 people in one place. And everything was kind of that whole peace, love, and happiness vibe, you know?
Yeah, and it was, well, I mean, you know, being the first one, I guess, and a place that a lot of people might have thought of as a backwater.
Right,
You know, I guess there probably isn't as much stuff left from it, and it was didn't get as much attention, that sort of thing. So I guess, you know, that probably helps in its low-key sort of success.
And it was the same with the Piedmont Park show because the following year, as you know, Alex did a second Atlanta International Pop Festival, and that, you know, was Hendrix and even bigger. Yeah. That had 300,000 people.
Yeah, I think that was a much bigger deal.
Because people knew about it at that point. So, yeah, I mean, it really was the beginning of the festival world in Atlanta. It really changed the complexity of the music scene in Atlanta, and it really is a significant moment in Atlanta's music history. And, you know, I hope now maybe people will have a little better understanding and knowledge of what it was, because I do think it kind of gets lost in the shuffle of when you talk about festivals.
Cool. Well, it was great to talk about this, as always. I love talking to you about music.
Our music conversation could go on for an hour.
Exactly. We could do this for hours and hours, literally. But it's great talking about this and a little slice of Atlanta music history. So thanks so much for bringing that.
Sure.
You listen to the music, you know, and have a good time, and you really enjoy it.
It was hippies and wannabe hippies and people that were hippies mentally, but they hadn't grown their hair out that long yet.
All communities fought these things in those days because they looked at it as a bunch of crazy hippies coming in and destroying their culture and undermining their children and youth and whatever.
Some remember it as the first opportunity to witness Led Zeppelin live in the South. Others recall the steamy sun and hordes of, as one attendee called it, hippies and wannabe hippies and people who were mentally hippies. A month before Woodstock would garner the headlines and catchphrases as the music festival that defined a generation, the Atlanta International Pop Festival at Atlanta International Raceway in Hampton established the city and the South as a meaningful player in the music industry. Debate continues regarding crowd size, with figures ranging from 80,000 to 150,000. Regardless, it was a lot of people for what is considered Atlanta's inaugural music festival.
All I remember was riding down there with my older brother.
David Michelson, music fan, musician, and festival attendee.
My friend, one of my best friends, a couple of us went in, and we were all going to meet up. So there's four or five of us in a car, and we drove down. And I don't remember having any of that traffic. We got there the first day, and it had started at like noon maybe or one, and we got there about two or three. But there wasn't like a program. We had no idea who was playing when or anything. And it sounded unbelievably great. Crystal clear, full power, as loud as you want, no distortion. I mean, it was just amazing. Unbelievable. We had no problem, no fights. Everybody was cool. Everybody was sharing, you know, everything. It was, all of that was just amazing. No shade anywhere. We saw that they had fire trucks come and hose people down. And people would just stand there and go, yeah, please get me. Some incredible, kind, generous person bought like a full semi-truck full of watermelons to deliver to the festival and just pass them out. And so there was like watermelon rinds everywhere. People were just, you know, cracking them open. I remember that. That might be all we ate. I don't know.
The lineup of the event, which took over the raceway July 4th and 5th in 1969, ranged from marquee names of the era such as Janis Joplin, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, to relative newcomers including Grand Funk Railroad and Spirit, to now legendary acts playing for their largest audience yet, Led Zeppelin, of course, and the Chicago Transit Authority, who would in later years shorten their name to Chicago.
This is Access Atlanta. I'm your host, Shane Harrison. We'll continue with more of our conversation about the Atlanta International Pop Festival. But first, here's more of our list of things to do and see. Folks strolling the Atlanta Botanical Garden will be met with humorous metal sculptures sprinkled throughout. A bouquet of flowers rises more than 30 feet out of a fountain. A similarly impressive tower of cranes reaches skyward, and a 7,500-pound gleaming white Pegasus is poised to take flight above the trees of Midtown. Even the garden's beloved topiary Earth Goddess gets into the act, cradling a metal peace crane in her outstretched hand. They're among the 70 graceful metal renderings of origami birds, butterflies, and flowers spread among 19 installations by artist Kevin Box in Origami in the Garden. Read our interview with the artist and learn about how he creates these monumental sculptures in our story on AJC.com. When the Illuminarium Immersive Museum opened off the Beltline a year ago, the company behind it was already working on a show focused on outer space. While the first immersive show, Safari, used real footage from Africa, the new show is almost entirely created on computer, which was a much more complicated enterprise. Space, A Journey to the Moon and Beyond, which opened June 29th, places attendees in an Apollo rocket to the moon and on the surface of the moon, along with trips to a psychedelic-feeling nebula, the constellations, the planets of the solar system, and the Kuiper Belt past Neptune. Find out more about this new experience in Rodney Ho's preview on the Georgia Entertainment Scene blog at AJC.com. Now it's time for this week's adoptable pet from the folks at Lifeline, who run the Fulton and DeKalb shelters along with the Lifeline Community Animal Center. Meet Brian Griffin. No, not that one. Brian Griffin is a very handsome boy who, like his Family Guy namesake, is super smart. A volunteer fan told us that he loves to fetch toys in the yard and then go on a nice easy walk where he just takes it all in. Given the chance, he will happily roll around in the grass and just stretch out and relax, followed by giving lots of kisses. He loves treats, listens well, and is eager to please and learns quickly. Brian Griffin is a definite catch you don't want to miss. He's at DeKalb County Animal Services on Chamblee Dunwoody Road. You'll find a photo of Brian and a link for more info on the story page for this podcast on AJC.com.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Access Atlanta from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The facts matter now more than ever. Get unlimited digital access to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution so you know what's really going on. And you're helping us fulfill our mission to bring you the news that's important to you. And now, for a limited time, you can get 6 months of unlimited digital access to the AJC for just 99 cents. Politics, investigations, breaking news, sports, dining, and, of course, all the arts and entertainment coverage I talk about each week in the podcast. And it's all less than a dollar. It's our best offer of the year for the best journalism in Atlanta. Go to subscribe.ajc.com/podcast to get unlimited digital access for the next 6 months for just 99 cents. That's subscribe.ajc.com/podcast to join the community for just 99 cents. Let's continue our conversation about the Atlanta International Pop Festival.
James Pankow, founding member and trombone player for Chicago.
It was one of three big pop festivals that happened around the same time. There was one in Dallas and another one in Atlantic City. Mm-hmm. We did all three, including Atlanta. For us, being a relatively new artist, it was incredibly memorable and exciting to be on a bill with all of the big names of the day. The first album was still getting its legs by word of mouth. We had not gotten on the radio because AM radio did not understand our music, and it was considered quote-unquote underground, if you can believe it.
That's crazy.
Not ready for prime time radio. So radio had to catch up with us, and hence we really did not have a national audience or any kind of notoriety because we could not get on playlists on the pop stations. However, on FM radio, the album was growing in leaps and bounds because it had become the required listening of college students around the country. They decided at some point that you're not cool unless you have the CTA album, and We therefore spent most of our touring doing college campuses and building on that sector of our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, slowly but surely, word of mouth grew and grew and grew and continued to do so. And not too long after that Atlanta Pop Festival and the other two, we were invited on the road to be by Jimi Hendrix to open his shows as his opening act. And that exposure was also huge for the band.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It was a combination of the pop festivals, which for us was maximum exposure in comparison to the college tours we were doing. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people at those pop festivals from
sure.
all over the country, if not the world, and so many of them were experiencing CTA the first time. So the exposure was huge. I remember being in awe of the amount of people at the site. There had to be, I mean, it had to rival Woodstock. I mean, not quite really. Woodstock was was historically over the top, but certainly the biggest gathering of human beings we had ever performed in front of. And it was a bit intimidating, honestly, to be on a stage and look out and see that huge sea of people was amazing. I remember talking to a lot of my heroes backstage. I met a lot of those people that were in various top acts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really an exciting experience for all of us because we were the new kids on the block, relatively speaking, and we felt really grateful to have been given the chance to perform with all those legends and in front of so many people. It was really a big deal for us, maybe the biggest thing we had ever experienced at the time.
The memory of legendary Atlanta concert promoter Alex Cooley, who died in 2015, is usually invoked in discussion of the Pop Festival. He was a founding father, and the festival also launched Cooley's career as a concert promoter, which would benefit the Atlanta music scene for decades. Peter Conlon, president of Live Nation Atlanta, he was a friend and former business partner of Alex Cooley.
It's a different time, and there was a real push to stop festivals like this because the powers that be, both locally and in Washington, did not like the idea of 100,000 to 300,000 anti-Vietnam War people getting together in any one spot. So there was a lot of political pressure on stopping these things. I can only tell you how he explained it to me. He was going snorkeling, and he was heading down to Key West with some friends. And at that time, he had a pizza place in Buckhead, and he was doing bands on the weekends because he had this affinity towards music. And they stopped in Miami, and there was a festival going on. And he thought that it was amazing that you had these groups and food and whatever. And he said, you know, we can do this in Atlanta. Alex had to cajole people to come to the South. One, they didn't think that they would be accepted here. Mm-hmm. They thought culturally that we weren't ready for rock and roll. They thought we all listened to country music. And he had to convince them. And why it was so seminal for us, basically in the Southeast, and a lot of people in the business know it, was it showed the agents and managers that there's a market for that here in the South, that there are people, not only with the first Pop Festival, which sold out and had over 100,000 people, but the second one, which did 300,000 plus people, and a year later. So it showed a lot of people that there was interest here. Believe it or not, Alex and I had that continual problem even in the city here, and doing shows for years.
Even that, in the 80s. When,
oh, Music Midtown, Chastain, Alpharetta Amphitheater. There's always people who, you know, fight or against, you know, rock and roll music coming into their it's only recently that it's been accepted.
2 days after the Atlanta International Pop Festival, the promoters felt guilty about making a few thousand dollars profit on the festival and staged a free concert in Piedmont Park as a thank you to fans. The Grateful Dead couldn't play the main festival because of a schedule conflict, but they headlined the park lineup. Earlier in the day, Spirit, CTA, and Delaney and Bonnie and Friends performed.
He made $10,000, and he felt guilty. Mm-hmm. And he's a partners because peace, love, you know, they didn't expect to make money. They didn't want to lose it. So he took that money, and he did a free concert in Piedmont Park with the Grateful Dead to give back.
2 days later.
Yeah. And that's what he did with that one. So
he
always did this, which he even saw at Music Midtown. He wanted an eclectic lineup that represented different aspects of a genre, and even sometimes different genres. He wanted people to be exposed to other bands. So he liked Led Zeppelin, and he figured, you know, people come to see Janis Joplin should really see Led Zeppelin. He never, I don't think, understood personally how much he'd done for the city. He understood after it happened that it had a positive impact and that it was changing things. But he also saw that on a nationwide basis things were changing. You know, all the attention that Woodstock got, you know, that there was this counterculture and this music coming up, you know. I mean, it's Dick Clark prior to that. It was all those created bands and tours. And, you know, and Vietnam was driving a lot of the music, you know, and people were using that as a way to express their dissatisfaction with the war, young people. But when I first started working with him, he was almost a pariah, you know, politically and socially in Atlanta, because people thought that this is the guy that undermined their children, you know, that now they were going to these rock concerts all because of this coolie guy, you know. If he hadn't bought these bands here, and you know, and so it took a while for that to turn around too, you know. I try to tell people that when, you know, people ask me or whatever, is that, you know, everything that happens now is because Cooley started it, you know.
The festival changed the perception of Atlanta as a music destination, and with the Atlanta International Pop Festival, a new tradition was born in the city.
AJC brings you the best of what's happening in and around Atlanta on AJC.com, along with deeper looks at trends in arts and entertainment and compelling looks at lost bits of history. Here's a taste of what you'll find there. Their final drive together replays in Ashley Siller's mind. Her husband, Gene Siller, behind the wheel of their black Silverado, their two little boys in the back seat, the moment when she said, "Our life is so good," feeling overcome with love, gratitude, and a touch of fear. Quote, "Our boys were amazing, our jobs were great, we just had so much fun on vacation, we really had it all," unquote, said Ashley. Just 24 hours later, Gene, Ashley's husband of 11 years and the father of her sons, was gone. On Saturday, July 3rd, 2021, around 2 p.m., a white truck was spotted on the green at the 10th hole at a local golf course. Gene hopped on a golf cart to go address the situation. Minutes later, shots were fired and Gene lay dead with two bullet wounds. Read the powerful story of how the family coped with this terrible tragedy and how Ashley is keeping her husband's legacy alive in Sunday's Living and Arts section on July 3rd. Or read the story online at AJC.com and in the e-paper. A sky full of vibrant fireworks, the scent of burgers and hot dogs grilling in the summer heat. The 4th of July is usually a day to gather with family and celebrate American independence. But for many immigrants, it's a day to remember the sacrifices they and their families made to start over in the United States. In search of a better life and opportunities, immigrants from South America to Africa to Asia move to the U.S., receive their citizenship, and create their own version of what it means to be American. For some, the holiday signifies freedom and opportunity. For others, the ability to make a difference and become part of a new country. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution photographed and interviewed 9 immigrants from 8 countries to learn what being American means to them for this week's Sunday Living and Arts section, which you'll find in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on July 3rd. You'll also find the story online at AJC.com and in the Sunday e-paper. If you're listening to this podcast on AJC.com, please take a moment to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast so you'll never miss an episode. And you'll be among the first to hear our new format when we relaunch in late summer. For more things to do in and around Atlanta, go to AJC.com. The podcast is edited by Tyson Horn. The theme music is by Bo Emerson and Billy Guin. And I'm your host and the AJC's Arts and Entertainment Editor, Shane Harrison. Join us next week for more great interviews and events.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.